Why do you think we do have such issues with around mental health in our society?
One of the things over the last 10 to 20 years is just the pace of life has increased exponentially. The changes that we have to deal with in modern society is way more than what other generations in the past have had to deal with. Also, like the rise of social media definitely has had an impact. We know that for young people and probably for everybody, the more time we spend on social media, it is associated with anxiety and depressive symptoms. To build resilience, it comes down to three things. This is according to the research. Support, self-belief, skills. Our relationships are the most important factor in building resilience and maintaining it. It's really important for people to know that your value is not based on your productivity, and you don't have to prove your worth to anyone. It comes from inside you. It has nothing to do with how much work you've gotten done or how many people like you.
Dr. Lillian, thank you so much for coming on to the Career Confidence Podcast today. When I saw your profile, what you've been working on, I thought to myself, I have to get you on because I know we're going to have such an incredible conversation. Your background, what you're doing, your work, it's so important, I believe, now more than ever. So I'm really, really excited about where this conversation is going to go today, and hopefully it's going to help a lot of people. But before we get into the depth of today's podcast, can you give the audience a bit of an intro into who you are and also what got you into even like becoming a psychologist in the first place? And what is also the difference between a normal psychologist and what you are, a clinical psychologist? I've always wondered that. So over to you. Great to have you.
Well, thanks, Georgie, for having me. I really appreciate you having me on today. Yes, I'm a clinical psychologist. I've been working in the field for 25 years. I think the reason why I went into psychology was that I had incredible psychology professors at uni that inspired me in this direction. I think originally I had the idea that I was going to go down their track, which was toward academia and teaching others about psychology. But as I started studying, I really noticed that I really like working with people directly, whether it's an individual or in groups. And really getting to witness the change that can happen over time in a direct sense. So I really enjoy that. I did, I worked in sort of community health and public mental health for many years. And then I did kind of revisit that older dream of like, oh, maybe, you know, being an academic is, you know, I never got the chance to do it. Maybe I'll delve into that. So I did actually. I went and I worked at a university for several years. And as much as that was worthwhile and valuable, what I did discover was that I really do like to work with people directly. So I went back into public mental health and then started my own private practice about 8 years ago. And then more recently, kind of delving into the tech space and seeing if we can make these psychological strategies more accessible and affordable, and also kind of meeting people where they are. So I've been working on that for the last few years. In terms of the difference between a clinical psychologist and other kinds of psychologists, there are actually several branches. Clinical psychology is you get more training in terms of assessment, diagnosis, and treating mental health problems and disorders. Other psychological branches might have like a different focus. Like you might have counseling psychologists who are talk therapists who do also help people with mental health problems, but they may not be specialists in the assessment and diagnostic aspect, for instance. Or you might have educational developmental psychologists who really specialize in helping young people and children, and they might focus on things like ADHD and autism spectrum disorder that you usually see in developing when people are quite young. So yeah, there's lots of branches. And yeah, clinical lends itself to working in the public mental health system. And that's where I started and kind of got my broad experience.
Incredible. It's always something I've been incredibly passionate about. And I think my curiosity around mental health came about through my own mental health challenges. So when I was in my early to mid 20s, I've said this before in the podcast, but I really, really struggled with anxiety. And I just couldn't get a grip of it. Like, it was for about a 3-year period of my life, I was having constant panic attacks. I was having constant racing thoughts, negative thoughts. And throughout the years, I've sort of always, I know exactly what happened. It all came down to, I was in a very high pressure job. I was on a visa at the time, and it started with just a thought. And then over time, I became anxious about being anxious. And I was like panicked about the next panic attack. And it was just that spiral, right? So what started as quite a probably like just worrying thought, what shocked me in that 3-year period was how quickly it almost became uncontrollable. So what, and look, from speaking to a lot of people, I've actually yet to meet anyone in life that's not struggled in some form with some sort of mental health, you know, whether it's anxiety, depression, you know, just a constant stream of worry. Like, in your profession, your professional career, like, what have you seen? Like, it just seems to be so rife in our society at the moment. And, you know, I was speaking to my parents the other day. Obviously, it wasn't discussed in their generation. What's been your experience throughout your career, and why do you think we do have such issues with around mental health in our society?
Well, we certainly have been seeing an increase in mental health issues over the last decade, and definitely has definitely spiked over the last few years for more obvious reasons. I think there's a few things at play. I guess one of the things over the last 10 to 20 years is just the pace of life has increased exponentially. The changes that we have to deal with in modern society is way more than what other generations in the past have had to deal with. And we're, I guess, still trying to figure out what the impact of that is on developing brains. You know, like, it of course, it impacts us as adults, you know, in terms of how we feel, how much stress we feel, and whether we feel anxious or depressed even. But on developing brains, it's going to have even more of an impact. And that's going to carry through into their adulthood. So I think that's two of the major factors. Also, like, the rise of social media definitely has had an impact. We know that, you know, for young people, the more, and probably for everybody, but for, you know, the more time we spend on social media, it is associated with anxiety and depressive symptoms. So that's not helpful. There's also, I guess, a still stigma, you know, around mental health issues. It's gotten a lot better. There's certainly a lot more knowledge and understanding about some mental health issues like anxiety and like depression. Those aren't the only mental health issues around, first of all. So there's not maybe a lot of knowledge about the other ones. But even with these more common ones, there's still stigma about asking for help and seeking professional help in particular. There's a lot of research, for instance, that shows how long it actually takes to seek mental health professional support. It takes, for anxiety disorders, it can take up to 20 years, depending on which disorder it is.
Wow.
Panic disorder is the one that has the least amount of time before someone gets help, because it actually has such a physical manifestations that people think there's something wrong with them physically, so they go see someone about it, which is usually their doctor. And it's then where they learn, well, I don't have anything physically wrong with me. It's actually potentially a panic attack. And they might go and get professional help as a result of that. But that's really the only reason. When we talk about something like what's called generalized anxiety disorder, which is essentially a disorder characterized by worrying a lot, and that can sometimes have a physical impact on you as well. and often does, but people don't seek help for that for up to 20 years because it's just seen as like, just, well, I'm a worrier. That's just who I am. I can't really do anything about this. It's part of kind of normal life, you know, especially among women, to think, you know, well, this is just part of being a mom, or this is just part of being a woman, you know, like worrying is how I show love. And they ignore kind of the impacts of that, and they just keep going until they can't go anymore. And then finally they seek help. And I think even statistically, people who have mental health issues, there's a very low percentage who will actually see a psychologist or a mental health professional for that. They might see other people, maybe 25, 30% might see their GP, and maybe 8 to 10% see a psychologist, and the rest, I mean, a lot of them aren't getting any help. So we have all of these issues. And then, of course, we had, you know, during the pandemic, so many more stressful things going on. We had worries about our health and our work and our finances and our families. And a lot of people were experiencing loneliness. And we really saw anxiety and depressive symptoms spike among kind of the general population, like 2 to 4 times. More. And so now that we're kind of post the crisis part of that, we're still got the after effects of all of that upheaval that, you know, all of that heightened stress and anxiety we felt during that time and all the change that occurred during that time and how it's impacted our sense of safety and security moving forward as well. And then all the changes in society as a result, you know, the change in workplaces and the structure and the change in our tolerance to people coughing and sneezing. You know, like there's so many things that have changed fundamentally after that experience. So there's a lot of reasons why we're seeing a lot of stress and anxiety and other problems and disorders at the moment.
It's been a big 3 years. Like, you think we've gone from a global pandemic into a recession. Like, so many people are struggling to cover their bills. Like, I read a LinkedIn article to say that 5% of the Australian population now can't actually afford just to get by. Like, they are now defaulting on their mortgages. And it's been a really, really tough 3 years for a lot of people. And I was listening to another podcast the other day, and they were saying, like, we're not going to know the impact of this for decades and generations to come, because it's also the younger generation that I worry for as well, because, you know, they've been stuck at home in a time where, you know, when I was a teenage girl, I was out exploring, getting to know myself, being social. Like, I really worry about what that period's done for the younger generation. Have you sort of seen any research or experienced anything or even got an opinion on what that has done for the younger generation and what impact that could have for their future, but also the future in general, because they are going to be the future in the workforce and then raising children as well. Like, what could that have had? What impact could that have on our future and their future as well?
Oh yeah. Look, the research is definitely showing, and this is research in Australia, that anxiety and depression and psychological distress has risen among young people even prior to the pandemic, but it certainly has spiked after. So there's definitely going to be an impact. Like you said, we're not sure what the full extent of that is going to be. But we as families and workplaces and communities need to be mindful that we were prepared to be resilient for that kind of situation and circumstance. And now that we've experienced it, I guess we have gained some resilience around an experience like that. But on a developing mind, having gone through that and also having missed out on a lot of opportunities, socializing, communication skills, some of their education that they're never going to get back. Yeah, it's going to have an impact. And it's really important to support young people now more than ever, and build, I guess, a new sense of resilience in young people through a variety of avenues. I always say, like, to build resilience, it comes down to three things. This is according to the research, not just me. support, self-belief, skills. Those are kind of the main things. Our relationships are the most important factor in building resilience and maintaining it. So making sure that our young people have those supports, those close relationships within families, those, you know, solid, trusted relationships within workplaces, and the supportive avenues and resources if people need extra help, especially in the mental health space.
Got it. We're going to go into some strategies in a bit because, you know, I think it's really important to get a sense of where we're at. And then it's like, what can we actually do to make sure that we take control and we take responsibility and we try and do everything we can in our own lives to overcome and stop worrying. I know you're going to sort of go on to talk about how we can contain our brain, which is your company. But I want to just go back to something you just said there that I fundamentally believe that there's a reason why this podcast is called Career Confidence, because it does all come back to your levels of self-belief. And I was trying to really reflect the other day on my own childhood. And one thing that I noticed that my mum did very well is that I never, ever, as a young girl or a teenager, saw my mum put herself down. Ever. She'd come into my room and she'd be having a trying on session and she'd say, "Doesn't this look fabulous? Doesn't this look great?" Like, I never saw that woman put herself down, right? But not in an arrogant way, in a very endearing way. I think maybe this, I don't know if this was conscious or unconscious, but I think she just installed that level of belief in myself that in order to do things in life, you've got to believe in yourself. And it really does make me feel sad when I see young people, like, they're timid, they're more shy, they're more, I feel like we're seeing a lot more introverted younger people that are scared to put themselves out there, or they're very confident on their phones or video, but then you meet them in person and they're shy and intimidated by going and meeting new people and communicating. And then this is going to have an impact on the workplace, you know, when they're put in a work situation and they're having to meet with clients or other co-workers. So in your sort of view, like, you've got young children, you mentioned there as well, like, how are you installing self-belief, support and skills into your children? Because we know if they're the skills that's going to build resilience, which I think is going to be a very needed skill in the future. Like, any advice for people that have got young, that are in charge of young people, whether that's, you know, they know young people, their parents or their teachers, how can we make sure that we're building at the next generation of resilient people that are also have those high levels of self-belief?
Yeah, look, that's a loaded question, but definitely, I know. Definitely answerable. In terms of support, I think it's really just important to listen and validate. I think that as parents, we are problem solvers. I mean, as people, we're problem solvers. Everyone wants to solve their problems. That makes perfect sense. But sometimes there's time to solve a problem and to try to fix things. And sometimes it's just time to listen and not go straight into fix it mode. So I'd say one of the best things you can do is spend time with your children, just listening, just asking open questions, being curious, but not curious in like a pressured way. Like, tell me about your day. What happened here? What happened there? Why did you do this? Why did you just like, no, just leaving it open. Knowing when is a good time to have those conversations can be really helpful too. Like, I know that if I'm asking a question straight after school, it's like shut down almost immediately. It's like, I don't feel like talking right now. I just finished school. I'm tired. But if it's like just before bed, great time. Much more open, much more receptive. And have those kind of more deep and meaningful conversations. usually at night for my children. And it might be different for yours, but it's about kind of observing, you know, the rhythms of your own kids and seeing when are they more willing to open up with you and when are they not. Another really interesting thing, this came from one of my professors, Dr. Marshall Duke. He did a lot of research on telling family stories. And what he found was that families who share stories about their family's history, not just of the immediate family, but generationally, like what happened in their family. They might be, not just fun stories, but also like things that were overcome, hardships that people went through and how they got through them, just like sharing the family history. What they found was that that helped build children's self-esteem because they felt this sense of belonging and connectedness that was more than just who they are individually now. They were connected more to their family and the people who came before them. And that can really help build and maintain your children's self-esteem, just sharing, having those times where you can share stories, whether that's at the dinner table or on a road trip or, you know, wherever you have those conversations, making time for that. I think the other thing is just valuing your kids. I know that sounds like it's very broad, but just the practical things that you can do, like spend quality time. When your kids walk into a room, show that you're interested, like you're happy to see them. When they're talking to you, a lot of us are just still, you know, scrolling or doing work on our laptop. I do this too. Like I'm still typing or, you know, writing an email. And I have to mentally tell myself, no, your child's talking to you. Stop doing what you're doing and look at them. Show them that you're paying attention. Show them that you're interested in what they have to say. And if you don't have time, actually look at them and tell them that, you know, that you do really want to hear what they have to say, but, and maybe we can do that in 10 minutes or in an hour, whenever you do. So showing that you value them and you can show them that by respecting their needs and wants, by not invalidating them. There's lots of ways that we invalidate young people or really anybody, but like little things, like if they say they don't like something that, you know, you serve them for dinner and you know, like, no, you do like it, you know, like, or, you know, I'm not hungry. Yeah, you are hungry. You know, like there are some things that we just say, it just seems to like come out of you when you're a parent. you must feel this way, or this is how I feel this, so you should feel this way too. Stepping back from that and like observing yourself saying those things and then stepping back and saying, actually, this is their experience and their experience is also valid. And teaching them to stand up for themselves in that way too. My children are teenagers. They're not that young anymore. So I do get that. You're a psychologist, aren't you? Shouldn't you be able to communicate a little bit differently? So they catch me on the times where I'm, you know, not being a validating parent. And I think the other thing, though, is you're not perfect. And it's actually okay to show that you are not perfect, that you have your days where you might say and do things that aren't the best, that you're not always the best version of yourself. And that's okay, too. And that if you do something to hurt someone's feelings or harm a relationship in any way, that you can repair that, and showing them how to do that as well. So I think all of those things in combination, and then also modeling skills that you think are going to help them in the future. So communication skills, how you deal with challenging situations, how you deal with getting work done that you don't want to get done, you know, doing chores that you don't want to do. How do you show that practicing helps you progress rather than it just being a talent, you know, and everything should come easily? It's like, no, you can actually learn skills and have that growth mindset. All of those things are so important. So, and you know, the regular stress and relax, you know, stress and anxiety reduction skills like breathing and relaxation and mindfulness and how to manage difficult emotions and distress and challenging circumstances. All of those things are life things. Those are how we're going to get through, you know?
100%. And these are all things that I wish that I'd learned in school, because I think I would have avoided a lot of my own mental health issues as well. And one final thing I'd say about my own upbringing as well is the one thing that was installed in me is work ethic. And actually, sometimes you just need to just suck it up a bit and get on with it. And there is, I think there's this balance that needs to maybe, look, I'm not a parent, right? So this is just my observation. But I think my mum was more of the nurturing one. My dad was more of like, you know, to get something in life, you work for it. You work hard. We get up. We're not lying in bed. Like, we were never a family that was lying in bed. Like, my dad was up, you know, first thing on a morning, whether it was over the weekend, doing something outside. Like, he worked very hard. And I think what he taught me was that to get what you want in life, to achieve any goal, there does need to be an element of discipline. But I think had my mum not given me the self-belief and the nurturing and all of those sort of skills as well, then I probably could have been a busy full workaholic and ended up going down a dark path as well. So there's just this blend, isn't there? And I think, and I take my hat off to parents, because I think it's so hard to get right, but it's like giving yourself some grace and just thinking, you know, that you're only doing your best, and a lot of people are winging it. But the biggest thing I think that you've got to do as a parent is make sure you look after you, because if you're being a parent and you're not looking after yourself, your mental health, your physical health, then you can't show up for your kids, you can't show up for your coworkers, you can't show up for your family, any relationship, if you're not taking care of you. And I think that there is this stigma in our society that maybe almost feels like, you know, if you go into the gym, you know, if you're going doing something for you, or, you know, you're being selfish, you've got to put others first. And I think that's such a brawl in our society and one we need to watch, because when we're in a good place, we then can help others as well. We can't pour from an empty cup. I really do believe that. Thank you so much for listening to today's podcast. I wanted to quickly pop in and talk to you about our amazing supporter, CH Talent Solutions. We are an IT and digital recruitment company based in Australia. If you are someone right now looking for a new opportunity or considering a career pivot, please reach out to one of our consultants. Or if you are somebody looking to build your team or build your company or scale, again, please reach out to us if you are looking to find the best tech talent fast. I look forward to connecting with you. Now back to today's episode. Enjoy.
That is true. I think that, we call it self-care. I guess the other side of that is I hear a lot of people feel that they're the pressure to self-care.
Mm, yes.
You know, it's like another thing that I have to do and I'm not doing right because I can't fit it into my schedule. So you've got, you know, like the stigma potentially of, you know, you're doing too much for yourself versus I am supposed to be doing something for myself, but I'm not. And so I feel guilty and frustrated with myself all the time, which is not where you want to be as well. So I would like to encourage, like you said, women to take that time for themselves, but also recognize that sometimes it's hard to put yourself first. You can't put yourself first sometimes. And sometimes that self-care or self-concern or compassion that you have for yourself can just be a moment in time. It doesn't have to take an hour. It doesn't have to be about going to the gym for an hour, or it could be going for a walk for 5 minutes, if that's what you have. You know, work within your own circumstances and limitations for that day. And even 5 minutes can be something that helps you reset and make you feel like you've done something for yourself. And don't discount the 5 minutes. If you've got 5 minutes, just take the 5 minutes.
100%. Yeah, I love that. I think that something that I've sort of implemented into my life is I'll go for a walk around the block a few times a day after I've eaten a meal, because I find sometimes if I have a meal and it just sits on me and I sit at my desk, I actually feel like I don't have as much clarity. So one thing, I sort of listened to a podcast recently, and he was a nutritionist, and he said, try just walking around the block just for 5-10 minutes after each meal. And I've just by implementing that, I've noticed that I'm not as sluggish straight after a meal. Cause you know how people say, oh, you have a meal and you get the afternoon slump, just by just sort of like moving. So, but then you think, oh, 5 minutes or 10 minutes, that adds up to the end of the day of like a 30 minute walk. And you go, right. Oh, there you go. Easy. That was just so easy to slot into my day, and it just didn't feel like anything. So yeah. You're so right. Just 5-10 minutes. I think we can all find that. And if we can't, then I think it's time to sit down and look at your life, because something's out of balance somewhere.
Yeah.
But look, let's talk about worrying.
Okay.
I just, there's so many people, honestly, that, like I said, when I reflect back on my own mental health, getting control of my thoughts, I found it so hard. And even now, if I'm truly honest, like I'll have days where I just constantly just keep on thinking a thought, and I'm going, why am I thinking that thought? Like, what a silly thought. And it's normally like the worst case scenario, doomsday's coming. And I catch myself doing it. And I've got practices now that I can do that, you know, help me get through those moments. But why do we worry? What can we do to stop ourselves from worrying so much? Could you talk about the amazing product and tech that you've created around Contain Your Brain, like so we can worry less and live more?
I love it. So, well, look, worry is part of our natural kind of human experience. It's part of anxiety. We know that we have anxiety to help. I don't know if everyone knows this, but anxiety is there for a good reason. It's not something we want to get rid of. It's there to protect us. So, and worry is kind of our thoughts expression of that. So it's about our brains anticipating like what could be problems in the future and alerting us to that. That's what it's for. What tends to happen when it becomes problematic is we get stuck on worries. We, without coming to any kind of resolution or solution. So it becomes, it, instead of being a functional thing that helps us kind of prepare and protect ourselves, it actually becomes something that keeps us stuck. And like you said, sometimes that can turn into catastrophizing and those kind of doomsday scenarios and imagery and, in more severe cases, it can turn into trying to quell those worries in unhealthy ways through checking behaviors. You know, like if we think about obsessive compulsive disorder, that's what that is. It's like, how do I relieve my worries? I'm going to do these kind of behaviors to relieve them, or I'm going to do something in my head that's going to relieve them. And rumination, which is like worry, slightly different because it's mostly focused on worrying about the past rather than worrying about the future. And it's often more associated with depression, whereas worrying is more associated with anxiety. But so we know what worry is. It's there for a reason to help us, but often it's not helping us. Just like anxiety, right? Anxiety is there to help us. But if it's firing up at a time where we don't need it, or it's too intense, or it's lasting too long, or it's too frequent, then it's a problem. It's becoming dysfunctional. We need to learn ways to manage that.
Mm-hmm. So how can we go about managing it? Because for me, the first thing was becoming aware of the thoughts, challenging the thoughts. I meditate every day. I journal every day. These have been two fundamental practices that have honestly changed my life, because just becoming aware of it, writing it down, where does that worry stem from? Because I feel like there's the base worry, and actually you peel it right back. It's, you go, ah, that's it. Bingo. That's the real worry. So how can we go about in our society, if we do find ourselves worrying, if we do find ourselves focusing on the worst case scenario, what's the first step we can take to start overcoming worry, because it can absolutely take over our life and it can literally suck the joy out of life if we just find ourselves in this constant spiral of negative thought and worry.
Yeah, I mean, you've just mentioned several of the strategies in that. So like one of the things that's really helpful is, like you said, becoming really aware of your thoughts. And you can do that via journaling or writing things down. A psychologist have this in CBT, which is cognitive behavioral therapy. We usually, you know, give our clients like a chart to fill in if worry or anxiety is a problem. And what they fill in the chart is, when they start feeling anxiety or worry come up for them, they write down their feelings and they write down their thoughts. And then they will write down the situation that was occurring at that time. And they might rate like how anxious they were feeling as well. And when you do that for a couple of weeks, what you actually find is a pattern emerges. The kinds of thoughts that you think, situations potentially that trigger those thoughts. And once you kind of understand what those patterns are, then you can start doing something to intervene. So that's a really helpful first step. We call it self-monitoring. It involves writing, but also being mindful, because you have to be mindful in the moment of like what's actually going on in the moment to be able to say, I'm feeling anxious. I'm thinking this when I'm anxious. Now, in terms of strategies to overcome it, again, you mentioned a few. One can be, I kind of think of it as there's two kinds of pathways to helping with this. One is like the change pathway. So we're doing something to change how we're feeling. For instance, we might say, oh, this is the pattern of thought that I'm having. I tend to catastrophize things. So when I notice that thought, what I'm going to do, the change strategy would be, I'm going to challenge that thought. I'm going to evaluate that thought. Is that really true? Where's the evidence for that? What would be a thought that is actually more realistic that I can actually say to myself instead? And then practice that, right? So that's changing the thought. Another way, though, is the acceptance way, which is, oh, I'm having that thought. I know what this thought is. And I'm just going to let that thought pass through my mind without engaging and attaching to it. So you don't actually have to necessarily evaluate it, challenge it, modify it. You could just notice it, label it, and then mindfully kind of let it pass through your brain. So those are two really helpful strategies for constant worry and anxiety. Another one is called worry time, which is what's connected to the app Contain Your Brain that I created recently. So worry time is a strategy that's been around since the 80s. And you said earlier, like, how do you stop worrying? Well, the trick is don't try to stop it, because stopping it doesn't actually work. They've done a lot of research on thought suppression. So when you try to suppress your thoughts, what ends up happening is it doesn't work very well. But even if it does work momentarily, it usually has a rebound effect, or can have a rebound effect where it comes at you even more strongly. And part of the reason for that is probably because those worry thoughts are trying to protect you, they keep coming at you until you pay attention to them. So telling yourself to stop worrying is counterproductive. But what they found was telling yourself to delay worrying works. So worry time is really about setting and creating boundaries for your worries by setting aside time. So a specific time and a specific place to worry, and then committing to only worrying in that time and in that place. So what would happen then when we have our natural worries outside that time is that you would write them down. You take note of them and you'd say, I've set my worry time for, let's say, 5 o'clock today. I'll worry about it then. And when you tell yourself that, you're not saying stop worrying. You know, you're not arguing with yourself and struggling with yourself. You're actually saying, oh, I'm paying attention to you. I'm going to write it down. And I've set aside time to think about it. And so your brain is much more likely to let go of that worry. And then also you get to contain that worry to 15 to 30 minutes a day instead of letting your worries run wild all day and, you know, taking your focus away from your life and your work, but also taking your sleep away at night as well, because that's what happens sometimes is we're really good at distracting ourselves all day. And then when we want to go to sleep, they all come back because there's no distraction anymore. And they're like, well, you haven't thought about me today. I'm going to bother you now. And they just like, you know, and then you get your racing thoughts either just before bed or sometimes in the middle of the night. So worry time can help with that. Now with Contain Your Brain, what we've done is we've combined that worry time strategy. So we help people set their times for worry time, but we also have strategies to help them address their worries effectively when they're in their worry. So you set your worry time in place. You add your worries in as they occur during the day. You can write them in or you can voice them in if you like. It's a really, what we've done with this app also is to make it really private and secure. So you don't have to worry about your worries being public knowledge or someone grabbing your phone and being able to see them. They're actually secure on your phone and we don't collect any data from anybody either. So that's really good. And then when you pick a worry to focus on in worry time, what we get you to do is we get you to sort your worry into a category. So is it something that you can solve? Is it something that is unsolvable or has it solved itself already? So when you are able to kind of differentiate, is this solvable, unsolvable, or solved, it matches you with strategies for the particular worry that it is. So if it's solvable, then we take you through the problem solving steps to kind of come to a solution that you're going to try to implement and see what happens. If it's unsolvable, then it's really about how do you deal with the distress of that and practice acceptance. So that might be via mindfulness practice. It might be through talking to someone. It might be through self-compassion practices and self-talk as well. And there's a few other strategies in there to help people. And then the solved one, which is this, I think, is a really interesting and important thing for people to know, is that most of our worries solve themselves by the time you get to worry time. And, you know, a recent study showed that 90% of our worries never happen. And so when you kind of know that and it's like proof, like you can see it in front of you, then reflecting on and understanding what those kinds of worries are, the stuff that takes up time in your head that actually isn't worth any of your time or energy because either it solved itself or it something did happen, but it wasn't as bad as you thought and you coped fine with it, then when those worries come up again, then they're probably not going to cause any distress or bother you, or it won't even take up any of your time because you already know that you don't need to worry about them. So it's kind of like a little simple strategy that can kind of teach you a lot and help you reduce your worry so that you can live more and work more and sleep better.
I love it. I love the idea of setting aside the worry time rather than just letting those thoughts just completely take over your work day or your, you know, your weekend. But what's really interesting for me personally is, and I don't know if you're listening to this and you can, you know, this happens to you too, but I noticed sometimes really interestingly that worrying thoughts come up sometimes in my life when things are going really well. And I read a great book by Gay Hendricks. I've actually interviewed him on my last podcast. And he was written a book called The Big Leap. And in it, he explains that basically we've all got these glass ceilings. And again, coming back to like your body and your mind just trying to protect you. As we go through life and things start going well for us, or, you know, maybe we make a stride in our work or our relationship, I've noticed that when things are going quite well, I actually sometimes have a worrying thought about my health, for example. Like I'll have a thought about, oh my God, like what if I get sick? And, you know, what if I don't get to, what if all this goes away? And, is it, and I go, oh my God, like you're sat here, you know, you've just had a great week. It'll be a Friday. I've opened a bottle of wine. I'm just sat with my husband. We're having a great chat. We're, you know, we've just had a really good week in the business. And all of a sudden my mind will go, oh my God, but what if you get sick? And what, like, what if this and then what if you die? Like, it's, and that's extreme, right? But it's an example of worrying thoughts for me haven't just come up when life is in particular struggle. Worrying thoughts actually, strangely enough, and maybe I'm not a psychologist, maybe this happens, comes up for me when my life is going really, really well in areas. And I'm like, whoa, this is new territory. This is all going really well. And I start catastrophizing about, what if it's all got taken away from me?
Yeah.
Is that, do you see that a lot in your work?
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely. Mm-hmm. I definitely see it in my work, especially among people who haven't had a lot of experiences of feeling content and happy. And then they worry it's going to be taken away. But also I think the thing that we need to understand about our thoughts is that we have thousands of them every day. And our brain, based on our patterns of thinking, attached to certain thoughts. So potentially for you, you might have developed a habit of, like, when things are going well, to worry that they might not go well for much longer. And sometimes it can just be knowing that that is a thought that probably will come up for you. And just being, you know, this is might be like more the acceptance pathway of saying, oh, that's one of those thoughts that comes up whenever things are going well. And just letting it with, don't, and not attaching yourself and feeling like you need to do anything with it. You just need to, like, it's like a mindfulness practice of like watching the thought kind of move through your mind without needing to change or do anything about it. Because we have so many, unhelpful, destructive, crazy thoughts that go through our minds. And most of them, we don't even notice because we have thousands of other thoughts going through our mind that are taking up our attention. And sometimes our brain develops a habit of noticing ones that are particularly unhelpful or destructive. And it's basically about understanding what that habit is and then finding ways either to break that habit or to notice it and just let it go. Both ways can be really helpful. But I think that that is a really common phenomenon, you know, when things are going well, especially, I suppose, because of a lot of the stressors that we've experienced lately too, that we know that things can change really quickly.
100%. I wanted to ask you that because it's always fascinated me. And when I read that book, The Big Leap, it's always kind of, he talks about upper limiting, you know, so when you sort of reach a point where things are starting to go really well, you're sabotaging other areas to kind of keep you at the same place that you've always got used to. And that sort of like thermometer of happiness and health and everything. And it's just like, when we try and make strides in areas of our life, we're trying bring ourselves back down and others. And it's always stuck with me. So when I'm sat having a glass of wine on a Friday after having a really great week, I go, oh, look at that limiting thought. Look at that. And I'm very aware of them, but it was just interesting then because I also want people to sort of understand that it's not just when things are going, you know, bad in our lives. Like, we're always going to have negative thoughts. It's just part of what's going to happen in life. And I think trying to avoid them in my personal experience has been the worst because then I go, I don't want to think that. And as soon as I say that, I start thinking it more. And then it gets worse and worse and worse and worse.
That's right.
So it's really important.
That's why mindfulness is so helpful as a skill, because mindfulness is really about, I mean, it's not only about being in the present moment. It is that, obviously, but it's doing that non-judgmentally. And it's doing that with all of our experiences, not just our external experience of like what's going on around us, but what's going on within us. So if we have a thought like that causes distress, that we can observe that non-judgmentally And if we can do it that way and be curious about it, or just be like, oh, yeah, I'm noticing I'm having one of those thoughts that I usually have when things are going well, that's going to feel so much different than, oh, my God, why am I thinking that? Things are going well. I shouldn't be thinking something like that. What's wrong with me? Right? You're just piling on more anxiety on top of the thought. And don't need to do that, because all it is a thought.
100%. It's just a thought. It's not real. No, that's really powerful. I just, I had to ask you that when you were talking. I was like, it's not just when things are going bad. It's, we're going through struggle. It's like sometimes when things are going really well in our lives as well. The final sort of thing I wanted to touch upon with you is something we sort of spoke very briefly about before we jumped on and hit record. But look, we are living in a society where there is, like we said at the start, so much going on in our lives right now, like the demand of our time. We live in a world where constant stream of information is coming at us. Like, you know, I remember when I first started my recruitment career, it was easy to go home and actually switch off, because I didn't even have like a laptop at that point. I just had my computer at work. And when I went home, you know, phones weren't as good as what they are now and things. So what advice would you have? Because I think we do live in a world where the pressure's on, burnout seems to be a real thing in our society right now, especially amongst people that are high achievers, want to do well, want to have it all. Yeah, what advice and what have you personally seen in our working world right now when it comes to burnout, stress, and how can we notice the warning signs? And then if we are starting to find ourselves getting stressed and overwhelmed, how can we stop that from taking over our lives and then going as far as burnout, exhaustion, and sort of then going through all of that stress that comes from that?
Yeah, look, the most important thing to know is that there isn't just one formula for success. There isn't one formula that works for everybody. It really is about you understanding you and what you want your life to be and what you value. So what is important to you? And are you living your life according to those values now? Or are you deviating from those values? And then if you find that there is a disparity between what you actually want in life and what you're actually doing, then working out how you can start moving towards what's important to you. And that isn't necessarily something that happens, you know, immediately, but you can start taking small steps towards the life that you really actually want. So I would say one is pay attention to what's important to you and what you really value. The second thing is, if you are starting to see signs, might be trouble sleeping. It might be that you're a bit short in your communication with people. It might be that, you know, your relationships are struggling a bit, or your work performance is struggling a bit. Sometimes burnout, which we usually associate with work, is potentially due to personal factors. So it can be really helpful to kind of identify where the stressors are coming from. Is it related to things that are going on in your personal life? Is it related to the kind of job that you do? Or is it related to the culture of the organization that you're in? And it might be all three of those things, but it's really helpful to kind of tease those things apart, because you might need different strategies for different stressors. And I think identifying those things is really important. As I, you know, mentioned before, judging yourself for struggling and feeling bad or being in distress or not performing well is only going to make things worse. So try to be kind to yourself and be curious about yourself rather than judging yourself, and really just notice what's going on and try to identify what might be leading to those issues. And if you can't do that on your own, that's completely fine. It's actually really hard to do that on your own, which is why people like me exist. So, or, you know, you can go to a friend or a family or a colleague or a manager, you know, your HR person, or you can seek out, you know, a mental health professional like me to kind of sort through what's actually going on for me and then what can I do about it. And do that all in a really non-judgmental way. And there are plenty of skills that can help people prevent burnout, first of all, but also reduce the impact of burnout and recover from burnout or stress or anxiety or depression or any other mental health problem or disorder. And, you know, some of the simpler ones, we've spoken about a few already, but, you know, relaxation exercises, for instance, like progressive muscle relaxation and abdominal breathing exercises or visualization exercises can all be really accessible strategies that people can start using straight away to reduce their overall levels of stress and anxiety. That can be really helpful. But I think one of the main things that people are often reluctant to do is ask for help. And so I would really encourage people to do that, because I think once you do that, you're reducing the stigma of asking for help. So you're probably going to reduce the self-stigma that you put on yourself and the judgment you put on yourself as well. And often when you talk to someone else, you'll be surprised to find how many people can actually relate to what you're feeling and what you're thinking, and any other issues that you might have. Like, a lot of these issues are experienced by everybody. They're just not all at the same time. And they're not all for the same reason. So the help's out there, and it's just about accessing it.
100%. And look, I think for me as well, like just sort of what you were saying then, I know a lot of people, myself included, not so much now because I've worked a lot on it, but I used to tie a lot of my sense of worth into my career and my work. So when work wasn't going the way I wanted it to go, I didn't feel as good about myself. And then, but what I would do then is I'd work more to try and make myself feel better. And then by default, I was getting exhausted and I was judging, I was self-critical, and it just became this rat race of constantly trying to prove something to myself, prove something to the world. And it was just a never ending, I feel like a hamster on a wheel. And the best thing I ever did was start to just detach this link that I had with my work versus who I am. That was such a powerful exercise, and it took a lot of time, and I still to this day struggle, like, you know, if work isn't, or my business is suffering, it's like, oh, like I'm not good enough. It's watching that thought as well, and it's just being aware. But I've done a lot of work on unpacking that over the years, and it's definitely helped me now understand my signs and understand when I need to pull back and just remind myself that just because maybe work's not going the way I want it to go doesn't mean that I'm any less of a person, and I can still take the rest and I still deserve the rest regardless of what the business is doing as well. And that's been a constant work in progress to me. But
Georgie, that's like something I hear all the time from my clients. It's really common. I think it's really important for people to know that your value is not based on your productivity. And you don't have to prove your worth to anyone. It comes from inside you. And it has nothing to do with how much work you've gotten done or how many people like you. You don't have to prove your worth.
I think that could be the title of the podcast right there, because 100%. And it's something that I've learned the hard way. And this is why I do the podcast as well. So I want people to know that, like you say, your worth comes from within. You were born worthy. You're always going to be worthy. You are enough. And I think so many of our mental health issues come from probably feeling that we're not. Look, I could honestly sit and talk to you all day. I think, you know, the work you do is so important, and I'd love to get you back on maybe in a year's time, and we can talk more about how Contain Your Brain is going. But, you know, final piece of advice for those people out there that are struggling right now, find themselves worrying a lot, find themselves in this constant spiral of you know, self-doubt and just not feeling good, what's the one thing that you could say to them that would, if they did it this week, that would potentially help them just feel better in a small way?
I think number one is support. Talk to somebody. I think that's the most important thing. I mentioned before, I can't remember now, but the number one thing that builds resilience is your close relationships. And if you don't feel like you've got someone around you that you can trust, there are people out there who are there to help you. There's Lifeline if you want to talk to someone on the phone. There's video, telehealth if you want to talk to someone by video, and you can see a mental health professional in person as well. So there's been no better time or easier time to access help. It comes in so many different forms, whether it's an app or an online program or via telehealth or on the phone or in person. Please talk to someone and get the support that you need.
Amazing. And I'll finish with this. I actually saw a therapist when I was going through my really bout of anxiety, and it really, really helped me. I also saw a hypnotherapist as well, and that was incredible as well. So I'm a big advocate for seeking help and seeking professional help. And then I think there's the tools you can do, like journaling, meditation, exercise, that can keep you on the right tracks. But just to help people get out of, if they are in a rut right now or struggling, help is out there, and please go and seek it, and don't be ashamed of that. Dr. Lillian, where can I send people who want to find out more about you, reach out and find out more about Contain Your Brain? Where's the best place for people to reach you?
Well, I'd say containyourbrain.com if you want to learn more about the app, and you can contact me via there as well. And if you want to know more about my other resources, drlilliannejad.com is a good place to go.
Amazing. Thank you so much for coming on today. It's been a phenomenal chat. And thank you every single person that has tuned in today. I hope you've got as much as what I have. So thank you so much. And I'll speak to you next week. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. If you enjoy these episodes, the number one thing you can do to help us grow and keep spreading our mission and message is to hit the subscribe button. And if you have time, give us a quick rating. Appreciate each and every one of you who tune in every week, and we look forward to bringing you many more episodes this year. Take care.